This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
This is a spotlight, which is slightly different. We have somebody here who is better known than all of us, and introducing someone like that is always a little difficult. But Craig Venter has joined us today, and it's going to be followed by Katrina Jameson and a patient. But this is in the area of genomics, and we would like Craig to talk to you about how he sees human genomics, or the genomics, the entire genomics field, if he likes, how he sees what's going on in genomics at the moment. We have an interest in this area. There's a very strong interest in stem cells and genomics. So Craig, for those who don't know, for some reason, is the founder and president of the J. Craig Venter Institute, which is built. It's here. The institute is here. Well, there's also an institute on the East Coast, but they're building a fantastic new facility here, and I think it's under construction. If I'm not, and it's one of these. One of these buildings, I think, you're going to have to go and visit one day because it's going to be so special and so energy positive for the environment that you just need to go and visit this place. So I've seen the plans. I think it's a great place. So this is a not-for-profit research and support institute, which has, I think, there are more than 400 scientists around the institute. And it's really invested in human, microbial, plant, environmental genome research, social and ethical issues in genomics, and synthetic organisms, which I think is an incredibly interesting area. And of course, Craig was the person who really led the sequencing of the first free living organism, and then the first human genome. He's originally really trained in UC San Diego in biochemistry, and did his PhD here. So he's a kind of homegrown Californian, and somebody I think everybody agrees is regarded as one of the world's leading scientists. It's my greatest pleasure to introduce Craig to speak to you today.
Alan, thank you for the very kind introduction and the invitation to come and talk to this group. This is a group that I've followed through the news from some distance, but I certainly want to start out by applauding what you've accomplished at a time when this field of research was subject to major political intervention, and I think you've helped change the world of research, and I really applaud you for that, and as a result, I'm pleased to be here to tell you a little bit about genomics, where it's been, where it's going in very dramatic fashion, and how critical it is to the future of stem cells. And in fact, I'm going to go so far as to say there will not be any clinical stem cell applications without understanding genomics and understanding the genetic variations that take place and to ensure that they don't cause more harm than good. So let me start with the building that Alan so kindly referred to. It's going to be certainly California's, if not the world's, first zero-carbon research building. There's some zero-carbon office buildings, but research buildings, because of all the complications of computers and fume hoods and requirements for air turnover, et cetera, are very hard to achieve zero carbon with. Here's another view of it, so you can see it's going to involve heavy use of captured sunlight for energy, but a lot of innovation has gone into this, and this will be finished in a little less than 2 years on the UCSD campus. It's also the first independent research institution totally not affiliated with the university to be on the UCSD campus And our faculty will have joint appointments with the UCSD institutions. Just to put it in context, we're just at the other end of a little strip from your Stem Cell Institute here. So it's probably a 7-8 minute bicycle ride between the two organizations. And I think obviously connected with much the rest of the world. Now, what we've been doing for the last 20 years or so is when we read the genetic code, we're digitizing that information. I actually refer to it as digitizing life as we read the four letters of genetic code and convert those to ones and zeros in the computer. Normally, I'm talking about our latest research, which starts with that digital code in the computer and goes the other way. And just a little over a year ago, we announced the first synthetic life form where we completely synthesized the entire genome of a bacteria and booted that up to create a first synthetic cell. But let me take you back the other way. In 1995, as Alan said, we sequenced the first genome of a free living organism using some, at the time, new DNA sequencing technology. And only 5 years after that, that led to the first draft of the human genome. This is the publication in Science in 2001. And then in 2007, the first complete genome. This is our team at the White House in 2000 with the announcement of the first genome with President Clinton. And here's the kind of technology we had then. It was giant rooms full of these $350,000 instruments. At the peak, we had 300 of them. This is a room with 100 of them. And in 1999, we had to build the third largest computer just to handle the data from these sequencers. But that computer at the time was small by today's standards. It was only 1.5 teraflops. We just celebrated the 10th anniversary of the sequencing of the genome, and I think this slide just proves that people look better in tuxedos. But here's the change in technology. Those giant rooms reduced to benchtop machines. And just last week, the latest announcement of this new iron proton sequencers from Life Technologies that changes things from a decade ago, the Genome Project was a $3 billion federal program. My team made great progress by sequencing the genome for a mere $100 million. And look at this now. It's down to about $1,000 for the sequencing. And this box can sequence a genome in about 2 hours. And it's amazingly simple device. In the respects that it has these micro wells on it, and each micro well holds a little strand of DNA. And as bases are incorporated one at a time into the growing strand, they release a simple proton. That proton changes the pH. And this is just layered on top of a computer chip where each little part of the chip measures that proton change. So it's a massively parallel device. It couldn't be simpler in design or more elegant, and it just really transforms what can be done simply by measuring that one proton release with the growing chain. We're going to be setting up sets of these to do what is now considered an assay. Sequencing the human genome is a couple of hour project, not a 15-year, multi-billion-dollar public effort. Fortunately, computing has changed as well. That giant room we had for the 1.5 teraflop computer, you can now add a teraflop to your PC with these small plugs. So a decade makes a huge difference in this field. And right now, the limitation is how fast we can get the ones and zeros off these computer chips and move them around. In fact, between my institutions on coast to coast, we set up dedicated optical fiber through the Lambda rail. But even with that now, that is so slow, it is faster to send the data by FedEx than it is by digital information, because each of these machines now generates terabits of information. In 2007, we did the first complete genome because, as I'm sure you know, you got sets of chromosomes from both your parents. And so that's called the diploid genome. What was done in 2000 was only half of that because as a $3 billion project, it would have cost $6 billion to get the full genome. So they settled for half then. And this changed our view of human variation. In 2000, everybody thought we differed by one letter out of 1,000 from each other. Now we know we differ by roughly 1 to 3%. So it's a huge difference. And part of understanding genomics is based on what's called haplotype phasing. That is, you've all asked the question of did you inherit this trait or that trait from which parent, and did you give this trait to your children? Well, now we can sort that out because we can sort the chromosomes, the digital information into the chromosomes that you got from your mother and the ones that you got from your father. And one of the ways we do that, just to show you the power of this technology now, we can actually sort out and isolate individual sperm cells and do a complete human genome sequence on one single cell. Because sperm is haploid, and there's roughly one crossover per chromosome, if we sequence several sperm, we can completely sort out the chromosomes. There's also multiple other ways that this can be done, but this just shows you the power getting down to the single cells. We're also looking extensively at genetic diversity. Vanessa Hayes at the Institute has been sequencing genomes in Africa, trying to trace the roots of humanity. And one of the genomes she did was Desmond Tutu's genome, along with one of the most ancient lineages with the Bushmen. And an early comparison was comparing the Bushmen's genome to mine, to a Han Chinese individual done by the Beijing Genome Institute. And it all came within this range of the 1 to 3% differences. What was stunning, looking at three different distant populations within Africa, had greater genetic variation than any African with the rest of the world population, because some groups migrated out of Africa, which led to our descendants. Some went back. Some stayed there. So there's tremendous variation in these populations, and understanding this variation is critical for the future. In fact, it's critical for clinical understanding. Pharmaceutical industry has fought for a long time having genomics be part of drug screening and clinical trials, but they're starting to change their minds, as this slide shows, particularly with Pfizer's drug. It had failed clinical trials with treating lung cancer until change in a single gene that occurs in about 2 to 3% of lung cancer patients. All of a sudden, this failed drug shrinks tumors in over 60% of these lung cancer patients. So now, knowing your genetic code, knowing your genetic variations, is part of the future of medicine and part of determining whether you're going to be treatable by existing drugs. And obviously, this pool of genetic-specific drugs is going to increase now that I think the dam has been broken, and people realize they can, or pharmaceutical companies realize they can still make billions of dollars even off treating subsets of patients, at least as long as insurance companies will pay for it. And you'll hear in a few minutes from Kat Jameson on how she's using DNA sequencing of stem cells to come up with specific genetic variations that lead to specific therapies, that you'll hear one very nice dramatic case. We're not alone with our human genes. We actually have twice as many bacterial cells in our body as you have human cells. And it doesn't matter how many times you wash your hands, that's not going to get rid of them. You have literally on the order of 10 or more million additional genes, additional to our roughly 22,000 human genes, in the form of our microbes. And a lot of human physiology is now based on the interaction of these microbes with the human physiology, and that's a key part of this new area called the human microbiome as we go forward to try and understand this. Changes in the microbiome are showing up now as causative in a wide variety of diseases, including cancer, obesity, diabetes, as you see from the list here, and the list is growing quite dramatically. The first cancer known to be caused by bacteria was obviously stomach cancer, with Barry Marshall's discovery of H. pylori that causes ulcers and stomach cancer. When you look at cancer over the last multiple decades, one really stands out in the U.S., and that's esophageal cancer. When we look at esophageal cancer and look at the microbiome, there's two totally distinct populations, one associated with those that have cancer and a much more normal population. It's not known absolutely whether the microbes cause the cancer or represent the changed state associated with cancer, but this is just one of the examples going forward. And here's a study done between my institute and the Vice Chancellor for Medical Sciences at UCSD, looking at changes with the microbiome in liver disease with alcohol. Most people think alcohol specifically damages your liver. It actually does so by causing bacteria to release a toxin that damages your liver. So I'm not a physician, and so don't take this too seriously, but I've suggested that we should fortify alcohol with antibiotics, and then we would not have any liver damage from alcohol. But that hasn't caught on yet. So our biology, our physiology is obviously environmentally influenced. That environment includes our host genome as well as the microbiome, and these will affect stem cell interactions as well as others. So we've been working, because my genome was the first one sequenced, with Larry Goldstein's group, who wanted to make some iPS cells from my skin fibroblast. And he did this, and his team has been characterizing these. The stem cells had normal karyotypes. And the karyotype is about as crude as assay is looking at a map of the U.S. and trying to decide, has California been split in two yet? It's not a very refined information. It doesn't tell you much about what's happening on streets in San Diego or Los Angeles. We have to get down to the sequence level. But they went on and made ES cells, and then went on to grow these up and make neuronal stem cells, and they've made neuronal cells now. So there's a number of labs in San Diego studying my brain cells and tissue culture. And they've come up with some strange findings, which doesn't surprise some people. But Larry said my neuronal cells seem to be taking over the lab. But also, they've been trying to use these to diagnose disease and predict future diseases like Alzheimer's disease. So in this capacity, I'm speaking more as a patient advocate of whether those cells actually represent the same cells that are in my brain, and would I want those cells put back into me. And one of the things we looked at with these neuronal cells and some of these cells is, does the genetic code change? And there's been a number of studies now on this by a variety of groups, including our team's collaboration with Larry's group. And we found, just even at a relatively simple level, a huge number of genes have substantial and important genetic changes. And here's just a list of some of these, and many of these are oncogenes and other genes that very much would affect cell growth and possibly create tumors. When you look in the literature, there's a number of other studies out there. You know, the standard karyotype analysis of just looking at pictures of the chromosome, most of these cells look like they're normal. But when you look at the DNA sequence, there's a huge set of changes. And this is looking at, I think, over 100 different embryonic stem cell lines in culture. Here's another one just showing a dynamic set of genomic abnormalities simply from putting these cells in culture. Groups have looked at the epigenetic genetic aspect of this with methylation, and finding as soon as you put these cells in culture, the methylation patterns change. And the methylation patterns are important in terms of regulation of gene expression. There's even certain things that come along with the maternal versus the paternal chromosomes that say whether your traits will be inherited. And all this gets scrambled as soon as the cells go into culture. So taking these cells and putting them back into people is obviously a problem, because alterations in DNA methylation has been clearly associated with genomic instability and with cancer. Here's just another study showing all the gene copy numbers. That's, you know, the expression of the genes that have changed up or down across the genome. So we're trying to understand where the genetic changes occur, why do they occur, and then ultimately, can we repair those changes? So numerous conclusions out there that you may or may not be aware of, but a lot of groups are calling now for extensive genomic screening, certainly of any iPS cells, but I think this applies to all cells before they would go back into people. Here's a study in the American Society of Hematology. Every iPS cell line will need to be evaluated over time for acquisition of mutations. At the Institute, we've developed some really novel single-cell technology that allows us to look, as I said, not only at the genome, the gene content and the changes in sequence of single cells in a high-throughput fashion, but also looking at gene expression and methylation in single cells. And this has been done with a number of groups. This was an additional study with Larry Goldstein, but these studies are ongoing with groups all around the Mesa on different stem cells. So we have tools to get a picture of what's going on in these cells that has never existed before. So the challenge is doing something about it. I'm not going to say any more about synthetic life, but through this process, we develop really novel ways to synthesize new DNA and to change the genetic code. So we think with some work, you know, even if there are extensive changes in various stem cell lines, that we can actually correct these changes across the genome. This has been done on one or two genes at a time, and there's a few studies on this. Here's one where they actually changed a disease gene in culture back to compare it to the same stem cells with the genetic change, so that cells serve as their own control. So they show that you can actually alter the genetic structure of these genes. And another study is, at least with the patient-derived stem cells, even where there were multiple mutations, when they changed them, making those changes didn't induce additional changes. So I think that gives us, you know, we have the tools to measure what is changing, when it's changing, hopefully how it's changing, and to change some of those conditions so we don't get the genetic abnormalities developing in stem cells. But in the cases where they do for individual stem cells, we have the potential to go back and actually correct these. And I suspect this will become a standard part of therapy, maybe required soon by the FDA, that you have to show the sequence before beginning therapy. If they don't require it, in my opinion, they should. So we're trying to build, in collaboration with multiple groups here, a stem cell genome center to enable rapid screening for diagnostics, such as for diseases like you're going to hear about in a minute, but to try and understand the causes of these genetic changes and to see if we can develop new techniques for correcting them across the board. Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So Craig agreed to take some questions before we go to the clinical work with the Katrina. So is there any questions you want to ask Craig Venter? This is your chance.
So that was a great presentation. I just was curious about being a core resource for CIRM, investigators, your institute, and whether that's been explored and what you think about that.
I think it's a great idea, and we've had lots of discussions with Alan and his team, with different groups around the Mesa, and it's a unique time where DNA sequencing, because the changes in the technology and the changes in the cost, it's now possible to bring it in a very active way into the clinic. It's actually cheaper for us to sequence your entire genome than for a female to have a BRCA1 gene test done by most other methods. So it is time to do this.
I'm sorry. I'm assuming you have the informatics capability to manage the output in some interpretable way?
So that's a very important question. So as we start to add on sets of 6 billion letters of genetic code from thousands of people, nobody has the informatics capability to do that. It has to be developed in parallel. We're using the San Diego Supercomputer Center. Over time, we've developed some unique software for comparing genomes. But to be very candid, nobody's done it comparing 1,000 human genomes to each other, or 10,000 or 10 million of them. So that's a set of computational problems that I think it's important for this group to help solve going forward. And I think it's will be done in real time as the data develops.
My question is actually very similar to Ben's. I think, obviously, one of the issues we have to deal with right now is that places like BGI and the Broad Center can generate tons of sequencing data, as can you, as can any university. And so I think you'd agree that the major challenge is understanding those data and not letting them just sort of ferment on some computer somewhere. So I'm wondering if you would think of that as a separate problem, separate from sequencing, or do you see it as part of the stream of sequencing and then understanding the genomes?
So it's a good question. As you said, it's very similar to the other one. It goes back to the very beginning of genomics. I used to have some very fierce debates with Jim Watson, who wanted them to be two separate functions. And I said, if we weren't analyzing the data as we were going, what's the point of doing it? So they have to be coupled. The centers that have, like BGI, that just invested billions of dollars in machines and infrastructure, they started at the wrong end because they don't really know what to do with those machines, and they're trying to build a sequencing service around the world. I think it has to be done on the basis of understanding the patients, understanding the diseases, and I think the example you're going to shortly hear is an excellent one.
Just a tiny more. Just comment on your comment. Do you think it makes sense to subcontract things like sequencing to BGI as opposed to setting up our own very large sequencing facilities here in California?
I don't think it makes sense anymore. The change in technology is moving so fast. The BGI facility is starting to look like our facility did 5 years ago, being very large, very cumbersome, and out of date. So the technology windows move so quickly, it would cost more to send the samples to China than it would be to sequence the genomes.
Dr. Venter, this is Joan Samuelson. I'm on the ICOC, and I'm the patient advocate for Parkinson's. I often hear scientists talk about the cause of Parkinson's as a blend of genetic and environmental factors, and sometimes they say genetics loads the gun and the environment pulls the trigger. Is that your perspective, or can you speak to that at all?
I don't think you can generalize genetics and the environment. We're probably far more genetically deterministic species than most people would care to acknowledge, including myself usually. But the environment is obviously key as well. So it depends whether you're talking about cell structure and function, which is almost 100% genetically determined, versus environment affecting things at the whole animal, whole species level. But obviously radiation, chemical damage, and other environmental components very much affect genetics at the cellular level. So cancer is clearly a disease of accumulation of mutations and genetic changes, but I think you have to look at each particular trait you're talking about to understand whether it's environmental, genetic, or both.
Thank you.
So it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Katrina Jameson to you. She's one of the critical members of research and a clinician at the Moores Center here at UC San Diego. And her interest is really in the area of leukemia and proliferative disorders of the blood. One of the best read descriptions of Katrina is you can find in Google. She's a rock star of science, and I think that slightly embarrasses her. But she's recognized really across the U.S. as somebody who's really, really critical in the area of clinical medicine and research. Katrina.
Thank you very much, Alan. So I really appreciate the opportunity here to talk about the importance of people when it comes to stem cell funding and how we apply these novel tools that are so eloquently described by Craig as not only coming to the fore, but you know, something that we're going to see in everyday practice, hopefully in the clinic very soon, and we're already starting to take advantage of clinically. I don't know if anybody watched the news this morning, but there was a terrible accident on a highway just near Santa Barbara where a woman and her two children were crushed in their car by an 18-wheeler who careened off the side of the road 100 feet down, crash, killing the driver. She was still caught in the car and asking for them to save her children. And they were so precariously balanced, every time they tried to pull the children out, the car started to go over the edge. Well, it just so happened that the Marines were nearby with a huge forklift and were able to lift the car off the edge and essentially save the day. I see Craig as having that forklift. And CIRM as providing the engine for that forklift so we can drive these diseases into the ground where they belong and not our patients. And we've got a very motivated patient here who I consider a partner in these studies. I think that if we put patients first, put people first, then we're going to get a lot further faster. And basically, I've coined this term precision regenerative medicine to underscore the importance of what Alan Trounson and John Thomas and the rest of the Independent Citizens Oversight Committee are trying to do here in terms of really being precise about how we accelerate the endogenous regenerative processes or how we plan our cellular therapeutic approaches. Because as Craig mentioned, there's really genomic instability in a number of the cellular therapeutic strategies that we're thinking of employing. So we really have to focus on the genetic and epigenetic mechanisms that drive human stem cell degenerative diseases that are the target of our therapies and think of how to precisely apply stem cell genomics to individuals with the same disease to identify interpatient heterogeneity, not just because we have different genomes when we're born, but also we're exposed to different environmental stressors. Having started my career in microbiology and got my PhD in that first, I agree that there's a microbiome, but also an inflammasome, and that a lot of the genes that we're seeing that are upregulated in the process of cancer evolution have a lot to do with inflammation. Now, so when we go forward, whether it's with targeted small molecule inhibitors, biologics, or cellular therapeutic strategies, we really have to identify the molecular drivers of treatment response and resistance in stem cell-directed clinical studies. And, of course, this poses unique challenges for researchers. Clinical translation is very important and really is the process of innovation and based a lot on competition. But here we have to collaborate. So it sort of goes against the usual academic model where you have to work with other people to get things done in an expeditious way. We have to have predictive experimental models so we don't get into the clinic and find, wait a minute, that didn't work. It worked in mice but not in people. And that's where we really have to partner with our patients to make sure this gets done properly because there are cell type and context specific mutations and epigenetic alterations that drive diseases. And we will only really understand that ultimately in a dynamic way by including the patients in the process. In terms of collaboration, I mentioned this can be a career killer. Really, a lot lot of people have been advised against collaborating, but I think it's absolutely required for getting us to the clinic quickly and doing the process of what I call reverse translation. When somebody is responding spectacularly well in the clinic, understanding why that is, and when they're not responding, also understanding why. This is predicated on having accessibility to patient samples that are adequately consented and clinical annotation for those samples, and most of all, to protect that patient privacy. We have to collaborate not just with scientists and physicians in academia, but also in industry to get these things done quickly because we all have different skills. And this is in the setting of decreased grant dollars. And so I think of necessity as the mother of invention, and it makes us work together sometimes where we may have been happily sequestered away in our own little places. Thanks to CIRM, we have a new building that prevents us from doing that because the one coffee pot is on the third floor, so I have to keep running down there. So it's actually making us all work together. So I think that's a really important way to segue into the leukemia stem cell hypothesis, to say that the way that we look at genetics has to be looked at in the context of particular cellular phenotypes and in those cells that are functionally annotated. So we have this capacity to look at genomic and epigenomic instability in the context of leukemia stem cells. As Craig alluded to, when you look at iPS and other cells that have been cultured, whether they be embryonic stem cells or even cell lines, they tend to become genomically unstable, and this is the process of oncogenesis. So we need to be able to dissect that out using real patient samples and model systems that can model those patient samples. Now, leukemia stem cells are a good model system for understanding the evolution of cancer because we can catch them at different stages of generation and basically look to see what events are involved in reprogramming normal stem and progenitor cells into these truly malignant cells that can recapitulate all aspects of disease. Leukemia stem cells were first described by John Dick, our partner PI in our disease team grant, as being able to basically recapitulate all aspects of disease in serial transplantation models. And what Irv Weissman and I and others showed later was that they were really derived from progenitors that had learned to self-renew when they shouldn't. So that's the cloning capacity of these cells that they can't turn off. They learn to differentiate abnormally, become dormant in supportive niches, and survive. So we've studied these diseases in the context of myeloproliferative neoplasms, which affect about 5 per 100,000 people. It doesn't seem very common, but the prevalence is going up as our treatments get better. So these diseases were first described in 1951 as disorders where we make too many of one type of cell in the bone marrow, either too many red cells in polycythemia vera, too many platelets in essential thrombocythemia. You can scar down your bone marrow as a result of those two conditions or as a result of chronic myeloid leukemia. Now, they all have clonal involvement of multipotent progenitors, and they make too many cells in the marrow, as well as having a propensity for extramedullary hematopoiesis as seen here, meaning you make bone marrow outside of the usual bone marrow sites. This patient, who you've met before and was on CBS Evening News, had this completely resolved on targeted therapy. So we'll talk about how CIRM helped with that. They all have varying propensities for clotting and bleeding, 36-fold more clotting than the general population with strokes and heart attacks in young people. The potential for evolution to acute leukemia also varies, but it's not something that people really want to have hanging over their heads. To understand how to effectively target leukemia stem cells, we need to ask what are the initiating events and those events involved in leukemia stem cell generation. And, you know, when you think of the first event, I think of what I see out the window now in this new office in the Sanford Consortium for Regenerative Medicine, and that's these people leaping off the cliff as they paraglide by. And I was watching this yesterday thinking, this is crazy. Do they know that they're going in the wrong direction? Although, you know, I think most of them came back. They came careening back onto the cliff. So basically, the stem cells go awry. They don't really know. It's not really a clever thing to do. And what we found in 2006, actually, was in the setting of polycythemia vera, the hematopoietic stem cells all have this mutation in this gene called JAK2. And that's there we found by sequencing, as Craig showed, at the level of the hematopoietic stem cell with the mutant allele being seen here in red. And this is transmitted clonally through to the progeny, the common myeloid progenitor, the granulocyte macrophage progenitor, and the megakaryocyte erythroprogenitor. So this is something that Sandra and I have talked about quite a bit, how much information is too much. So when we had that information in 2006, we were really basically told off by our oncology colleagues for giving that information to patients because they said, what are they going to do with the information? You don't have a targeted inhibitor. But CIRM helped through the training grant by providing funding for the talent that did the work through a seed grant, which was considered to be high risk, high gain for the latter parts of the study where we needed to get it published to actually get this trial off the ground. And basically, we were able to show that targeted inhibition of JAK2 in this disease when we transplanted polycythemia vera stem cells from patients was very effective at decreasing bioluminescent engraftment, as shown here, and also decreasing human red blood cell engraftment, perhaps most importantly decreasing the JAK2 mutant allele frequency that we know is really important in fueling disease progression to myelofibrosis. So based on these data and data from Gary Gilliland at Harvard, Ayelu Teferi at the Mayo Clinic, we went ahead with the clinical trial. This phase 1 trial included 59 patients, and I think somewhat surprisingly, we saw a decrease in fibrosis in the marrow of those patients. So things we thought were intractable turned out not to be. And so this was a very exciting find that led to the expansion of this trial into phase 2 trials, and then phase 3 are coming up in 33 countries now that Sanofi has taken over this. CBS Evening News did a piece on this because they were so excited about not just the promise but the reality of stem cell research, and that if you put the science first and you put the patients first, I think we can get it right sometimes, but it's all predicated on working together. Secondly, self-renewal, that aberrant capacity to regenerate, is something that we're trying to get rid of in these cells as they progress. And this is something that we've been looking at very closely with RNA sequencing, again, through our disease team, and actually spearheaded by Kelly Frazier and Mark O'Mara. This involves using the HiSeq 2000 sequencer, not the proton ion torrent yet. 50 base paired-end reads led us to see that it's not just DNA instability, it's RNA instability. There are changes in RNA editing that lead to increased splice variants that predict progression from chronic phase disease to blast crisis. When we look at those cells that are really unstable and have the capacity to clone themselves, what we found was if we take the same drug that I talked about before, that selective JAK2 inhibitor, combine it with another inhibitor that gets rid of the oncogene BCR-ABL that initiates disease, we're able to significantly reduce the self-renewal capacity of these cells in a serotransplantation model. Almost finally, we're interested in dormancy. How do these cells learn to go to sleep and resist our therapies in the bone marrow microenvironment? We know by studying these cells, the leukemia stem cells after transplantation, they like to go next to the bone and become quiescent with very low expression of phosphohistone H3. It turns out those cells that have the capacity to do that have activated a pathway called sonic hedgehog. And in humans, unlike in mice, they increase Gle2 expression. We can target that selectively using a compound that decreases Gle2 expression and therefore decreases survival in the bone marrow niche. And this is just showing nanoproteomics. We went to the clinical trial with this. Again, this was CIRM-funded work that led to this. The clinical trial phase 1 interim results were presented, actually by me, at the American Society of Hematology meeting. We had clinical responses in the patients, the 35 patients entered onto the trial in myelodysplastic syndrome, myelofibrosis, and chronic myeloid leukemia. And what you can see here is a patient that has really extensive scarring of the bone marrow, or in other words, fibrosis, and then it starts to clear out at about a month after taking this oral hedgehog inhibitor. Perhaps the most surprising thing was the response we saw in patients with acute myeloid leukemia. So this we thought was an irreversible process after people had progressed from MDS or myelofibrosis, and we saw really dramatic responses in 7 out of the 20 patients entered on the study who had AML. Finally, with regard to survival, we're not getting rid of all of the cells that are hanging out in the bone marrow niche, so we started to look at the survival signature, again by RNA sequencing, and found that the cells in blast crisis had a unique survival signature, and basically all this is showing is that they upregulated components of the BCL2 family that promoted survival in direct correlation with overexpression of BCR-ABL. So that's targetable. We're doing this through another CIRM grant, the early translational too. And really what this is meant to show is the science is capable of getting us to the clinic very quickly, provided that we form strategic alliances and that we use the best tools at our disposal to understand the right patient, the right time, the right opportunity to bring these technologies forward. So we have to develop accurate molecular diagnostic tests derived from DNA and RNA stem cell sequencing of functionally annotated samples. Now, to develop sensitive prognostic tests, we really need patients. And that's why I'd like to introduce Sandra to come forward. And I think she's a leader. We were talking about rock stars. Well, I think Sandra's a rock star. We met each other quite recently, and I consider her a partner in this research. And I think that when you're going to come up with patient-focused regenerative medicine solutions, you have to have the patient involved. And this is a dynamic interchange. We talked about the dynamic look at funding structure and the strategic plan. Well, I think CIRM's got it right with regard to the strategic plan in terms of putting patients and people first. So I just wanted to ask a couple of questions. I know we go on ad nauseum about this, but how did you first find out that you had myelofibrosis?
Well, it was about 8 years ago that I was diagnosed, and I was 28, and the picture of health. I ran every day. I ate healthy, didn't smoke. I recycled. everything I thought, you know, I was doing right, and I felt this little bump underneath my rib cage. And I went in, and after, you know, months of testing, trying to figure out, you know, what is wrong with you, they discovered I had myelofibrosis. Well, at the time that, you know, you all were doing your research, it wasn't there yet for me. And so my doctor said, well, this is what you have. There's no cure. There's no match for you for a bone marrow transplant. And what we can do is monitor the progression of your disease. And as you get sicker, try to mitigate, you know, and manage those side effects. I'm 28. Like, that's not okay. That's not an okay answer. There was no hope. I kept asking, well, what can I do? Can I eat just carrots? Can I eat better? Can I run more? Can I run less? Anything. And no, you know, there was nothing. So it wasn't until I met Dr. Jameson that someone gave me hope. You know, yes, we can try something. You can work with me on this research. Mm-hmm. And I've been on this trial for almost 3 months, and my spleen is getting smaller. And this is after, you know, years of feeling like I'm trapped in that scene from Alien where this thing is just trying to jump out of my torso, and it would just hurt constantly. And that was my future, this perpetual pain and this exhaustion from this disease. Like, I was constantly stuck on the top of a mountain where there just wasn't enough air and I couldn't acclimate. I, you know, my friends would go out at night and they would be able to stay out past 8 o'clock, but I couldn't, and I felt exhausted constantly. And now I have energy. I'm getting married in March to my fiance. And I plan on staying out all night. So yeah, this has just been the most amazing experience for me, and I'm so grateful.
Well, we're grateful for you, Sandra. What do you hope for the future? What do you think we can do to make things even better in terms of your treatment or, you know, any kind of test we bring forward?
You're kind of doing the thing that I really need, which is this collaboration, this ability to be a part of what you're, you know, this research. Because I know that there's no perfect answer yet, but 8 years ago there was no answer at all. So I'm hoping 8 years from now, you know, there will be that answer. And, you know, you've also forced me to start saving for retirement.
Nobody's retiring here. Stem cell biology is going to work. All right. Well, thank you so much, Sandra. I really appreciate you coming here.
Soon? March 17th.
In Costa Rica. So.
In Costa Rica.
Oh. Okay. Fantastic. So are there any questions for Sarah or for Kat? I mean, What a great finale to Craig. Didn't upstage him, but it's just wonderful, isn't it?
We're a team.
Any questions?
Well, you gave us the opportunity. I remember when you signed our seed grant. Your signature is on it. And at the time, it was at a time where that grant was not funded because they didn't think that the JAK2 inhibitor that Sandra's on would be endorsed by the little company that was trying to produce it, or that it would be translatable into a clinical setting that would be meaningful. And you showed them that it was possible, so thank you, Sherry, and the rest of the Independent Citizens Oversight Committee for letting people plan for retirement. Unfortunately, I can't plan for retirement because Sandra's keeping us busy here. But, you know, this is the reality check. This is really what we're talking about when we talk about genomics. So we need major might here, and I think this is where Craig comes in. We need the intellectual prowess of the genomics community behind us to do this properly, and that's why I think Alan and Natalie have made this prescient suggestion that we move on with the genomics plan, and John knows exactly what the funding structure is and how important this is to all of our patients, and I really would like to laud the ICOC's efforts for putting the patients first and allowing the science to follow. Hopefully we'll keep in step with our very energetic patients, but I'd like to thank everybody for their time. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.